This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. We're recording on Thursday, March 17th, 2022. I'm Jeff O'Neill, here with Rebecca Kaczynski, coming to you from BookRiot.com. Last time you were all daffodils and hummingbirds, and now you're back into a 50-degree rainy. And for Richmond, that's winter, right? Essentially, that's a winter day.
It's late fall, early winter, it feels like. Yeah, I was telling you before we started here that yesterday I felt like Cinderella yesterday with like little birds chirping around my head, and, you know, like full springtime glory. And today it's disgusting. And I've just decided to channel a Sunday mode. So I've like made myself brunch and a new cup of coffee. And that's just what we're doing.
That's what we're doing. I will make your day feel better because I have a surprise game for you here in a minute, which I know wonderful. Always brightens your day.
In some weird form of Stockholm syndrome, I do love this.
Look, Stockholm's nice.
It's true.
I'm sure it's a great town.
Of all the places you could be held captive, Stockholm sounds pretty decent.
You know, it's true. Is Stockholm best known for the syndrome? Probably, right? Probably. No bells in hostage situation. If that's not a show title, I have never said one in my life. I guess one other thing before we do a sponsor break. We do have a new literary activism newsletter coming soon. You and I will not be writing this, though we were a part of. This would be a good idea for the site to do. The site meaning our array of properties, some of which are not websites, I guess. increasingly less useful metaphor for what Book Riot is and does. But Kelly Jensen and Danica Ellis, who are staff writers and editors here, have been really over the last year doing more of their own additional reporting and rounding up and cataloging and interrogating what's been going on in the world of book banning and censorships in schools and public libraries across the country. Covered a lot on the site, but a dedicated place where people can go who want to stay informed. And I would guess a lot of our listeners here would be interested in this. There'll be a link in the show notes. You also go to bookriot.com/newsletters. There you can see all the many bookish newsletters you can subscribe to. And we have a bunch of them. And the literary activism one you can find there. But we thought we'd take a moment because I'm sure there are we asked before explicitly whether or not you wanted us to keep covering these because there were so many and they all kind of felt like the same story but a different day. I feel like both in degree and kind have changed over the last year. And so this is light rising to meet the dark a little bit. Check that out. Link in the show notes, bookriot.com/newsletters. Let's do a quick break and we'll come back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story could make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/akillingonthehill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
Let's do the game first, because I think the Brandon Sanderson FAQ is actually more than just follow-up, I think, maybe. Or what do you think, Rebecca? Do you want to do game or Sanderson first?
Let's do the game. I think you're right. The Swaggerson update is juicy. Yeah.
So one of the big questions we have had is the COVID book-buying boom.
Oh,
is it durable? Is it going away? What I have, we're now almost a quarter into 2022. We're coming out of COVID. BA2, go away. I don't want to hear your name anymore. So I thought it might be interesting to check in on year-to-date print sales year over year.
Okay.
So year-to-date 2022 versus year-to-date 2021. And year-to-date 2021, I think we were in the white-hot center of COVID. There were some vaccines, but mostly older folks or people with immunocompromised or other special conditions could get them. The great mass, unwashed masses of us were waiting until summertime or later. And it was winter. And if there was ever going to be the pinnacle of print book buying because people are sitting around, it would have been winter last year. Do you agree with that supposition?
I do agree with that, yes.
Thank you very much. I win already. So what I'm going to do is I would like you to, this is going to be plus, minus, or no change.
Okay.
And I'm going to give you the category, and you can tell me if it's up year-to-date, down year-to-date, or flat. None of them are flat, so it's up or down.
Okay.
I guess is so. Would you like to begin with print books by format or print books by category to begin, like Jeopardy? Ooh. Which category would you like to start in?
I'll start
category
with,
or format?
With category, please.
Category. Your choices are, we're going to go top to bottom. Number one, adult nonfiction. For those of you who don't know, the single biggest category in books is adult nonfiction in print. I should say in print. The audio question and ebook we're going to get to in a minute when we talk about Brandon Sanderson. But this is print. So year to date, do you believe adult nonfiction is up or down over 2021?
Down.
Down. Any idea how much?
Oh.
Tough, I know. This is extra
credit. I don't know.
You already get
7%.
9.6%. I'm gonna award you full marks.
Great.
So adult nonfiction, the single biggest category of print books, is down 9.6%. Next category, adult fiction.
Oh.
Up or down, Rebecca Shinsky?
I'm going to say up.
Could you tell me why you guessed that?
Because some of these TikTok surges are adult titles. And
there
we are seeing record numbers of them. The Sarah J. Maas books are adult titles. I think Colleen Hoover is an adult title. It's not all YA, even though it's all kids that are buying them. Or mostly young, the youths.
The youths are buying
two
Hoover.
Youths.
It is up 9.9%. So almost
exactly
the same.
So it's up as much as adults are down. Okay.
Yeah. Though because it's a smaller category, we're still millions of units in the red because of the difference in scale. Juvenile nonfiction, for those of you who don't know, juvenile means kids. Young adult means teens, essentially, for lack of a better shorthand. But juvenile nonfiction, so kids nonfiction, up or down?
Down, because the kids are back in school.
Back in school, 9.3% down. Juvenile fiction, up or down?
I'm going to go down also for that
down.
Same reason.
Yep. 9.3% dip in nonfiction, 7.7% dip in juvenile fiction.
Okay.
How about young adult fiction?
Up, baby, TikTok.
Up. How much do you think it's up?
Oh. 12%.
5.9%.
Oh,
so up less than adult fiction, which I thought was interesting. And then young adult nonfiction.
Down.
That is up 5.4%.
Oh, okay.
All right. So your next subcategory grouping is format. Hardcover, trade paperback, mass market board books.
Mm-hmm.
Hardcover, up or down?
Adult? Or
this is all this. It's just by format. It's not broken out. This
down.
Time. Down by 7.7%.
Okay.
Trade paperback?
Up. That's the TikTok juice.
It is down 2.2%.
Oh, okay.
Mass market paperback?
Oh, down.
down 19.6%. Mass market paperbacks have just been taking L's for a decade, ever since ebooks came around. How can it even be down 20% at this point? It's like Omicron. There's not much that to lose. How do you lose 20% of nothing?
You know, I think it's that, and also that romance publishers especially are experimenting with these trade paperback size originals with cute little illustrated covers instead of just starting the cartoon contemporary
romance. Yeah.
Yeah. Instead of just starting at mass market paperback. And that has to make a difference because romance is huge.
Is it a cartoon illustrated? I'm not sure even. My visual art taxonomy is
they all look the same now, all of those covers.
The Jasmine Guillory's, the Casey McQuist. I'm looking at a couple of on my Better Half's nightstand right now. I know it's a new thing under the sun. And then lastly, board books.
Oh, down. Kids are,
you know, this.
Doing
things. Kids, yeah. down 7 point. What I don't understand, okay, we'll get to this.
First of all, can we just I have a really nice track record on this game so far, so I just want
you
to
do have a very good
myself.
Track
Thank
record
you.
Well, I thought this would be good because our sense is right. Right?
Yes.
Sometimes we're right about what our sense would be. I would like to think I would have guessed this, but in looking at these, I was like, that makes sense. So that brings us to the big kahuna, which probably I shouldn't say. That's probably appropriation. Never thought about this before. I'm going to go look at kahunas and from whence they come. Total sales of print books year to date, down or up, and then for bonus points, shining glory in the polishing of your polishable items. What percent?
It would have to be down, right? Because everything
has to be down. You are correct.
Basically, everything was down except for YA fiction. I'm going to say down 6.5%.
It's very close. Down 5.3%.
Okay,
we were down from in March of 2021, 16.8 million units. Sold to 14.1, so 2.7 million units down, even with the TikTok. I think that's the story.
With
the TikTok. Now, 2021, remarkable time. I think just because something is a high water mark doesn't mean when the tide goes down a little bit that we're in a drought. Does that make sense? I think that held up actually pretty well.
It does. I think we've been seeing some similar conversations just around like things, companies that were big stocks early in COVID. Yeah. Like, is it really that shocking that Peloton is not as popular right now as it was in like May of 2020? Probably not. Like I think for year over year comparisons are going to be really hard for the next couple of years to mean anything until COVID is like as fully in the rearview mirror as it can be. And maybe for now, looking at 2019 is an interesting comp.
I've also got another. I'm going to use a specific example that is, it's at the center of the Venn diagram of several things we've said right now. So this is Tess Bailey's new book called Hook, Line, and Sinker. Just came out. It is one of these illustrated cartoon romance trade paperbacks. And she got some juice on TikTok, BookTok especially. Okay. I'm going to give you her first week sales for her last five books, including the most recent one. This is nothing for you to guess because I'm just going to do it. I don't know how to do this. So June 2019, Fix Her Up came out, 1,066 copies in print the first week.
Okay.
Second book came out 6 months later, January 2022, Love Her or Lose Her, 865 copies in print the first week. Also, people out there, most books don't sell much, in case you've forgotten. Tools of Engagement. September 2020, so, you know, she's putting out a book every 6 months or so, 955 copies.
Okay.
July 2021, It Happened One Summer, 3,201 copies. March 2022, would you like to guess? Here's what it is. I guess I did wait. Would you like to guess what her March 2022 copies sold
and were? You said she got the TikTok juice? So this
And there's a reason we're doing this game, I guess is
what
I'm saying.
So this guess should include the impact of the TikTok juice.
And it's been since July 2021, right? So we're looking at almost a year. Her last one was 3201, which in fairness to, I guess, the game, was triple her last one. So she'd already seen a tripling.
Yeah. 15,000.
20,570 copies. So a seven times more, which is... Yeah, I mean...
Man, I love that we're getting numbers with the TikTok situation.
Yep. I mean, it's... And we've won... This is not a name I would have come up with myself, right?
No.
By my gentle looking through my fingers book talk experience, which is now has come to an end, I should say.
You've braved that. I haven't even tried it.
Yeah. So there, how many of these are there? Because that's 20,000. What's second week sales and what's durable? But there is, we saw the rising tide. I did a Google trend search for both TikTok and BookTok this morning in anticipation of this. Really, it was March of 2021 where BookTok as a search term in Google, I'm going to use that now for a proxy in general interest, right? People are like, what is going on? I don't know how it actually, This is boomers Googling BookTok or people like me.
I was going to say, how many of them think it's a separate app?
But here's the thing. That tells you something, right?
That's true. Yeah.
In the crossing the chasm way, the people who don't know how to program their VCR, getting into Laserdiscs is a thing. Right. And that's kind of what this is happening. Really peaked in the spring of last year.
Okay.
And TikTok itself had a real spike. Weirdly, starting before the month before COVID started happening is where TikTok had another hockey leg up. Now, for BookTok, for search terms, that has come down over the last 6 months. How is this going to play out is the next question. What it's doing now, is it harnessable in any way? And then what is the durable thing? Those are the three big questions about TikTok right now. The other thing I was going to mention is we talked last week about James Dont, chairman and CEO of the group that owns Barnes & Noble and some British chains, was saying they need a hit. They're looking for a hit. And I was like, isn't that what BookTok is for? I think the thing that's hard to understand for me is if I look at, you know, this is where my eye goes. And this tells you where when I open Publishers Weekly to look at bestsellers, I consider the most interesting list hardcover frontlist fiction. That's what I look for. The best-selling book last week in hardcover frontlist fiction was The Paris Apartment by Lucy Foley, which only sold 17,000 copies.
Yeah.
One Italian Summer did well. Rebecca Searle, I think you picked that in the draft because she did a different one. She had another one that came out before. Did some marketing with us, Disclosure, Take That With Your Will. It's out there, 11,000 copies.
Okay.
Here's one, The Sarah J. Maas, House of Breath and Sky, TikTok phenomenon, second week out, number four with 11,000 copies.
I think this one's a tricky thing to think about because the TikTok surges are on backlist titles. And most readers, just in the general world, are not paying attention on a weekly basis to new books coming out. And if you just got on the Sarah J. Maas train from TikTok, like in the earlier part of this year, you might not be ready for the next book, like, you know, for the newest book yet. Or maybe you just read the first one and you're not going to stay on the train the whole time. Like, we also don't know the long, like, series impact of those TikTok, you know, popularity phenomena for the later books in those series when it's a series they're talking about. So I think my gut instinct was also like, oh, that seems low given her broad popularity. But like, how is that TikTok popularity translating to the longer tail of book sales? Are those people like following her on Twitter and Instagram or wherever kids follow people these days? Are they signing up for her email newsletter so they'll know when her new books come out? Like, can they be marketed to directly in some fashion, which of course is the thing that the publishers are trying to crack. But the fact that those books that are taking off on TikTok are older, I do think is interesting and might be complicating how those little surges, not even little surges, how those big surges are translating, or rather not translating, into sales of the newest titles from these authors.
That's very reasonable. My counterpoint would be this, which is Colleen Hoover's new book, Verity from Grand Central, sold in its second week, sold more than twice as many copies as the Sarah J. Maas. So similar, it's got a new book, the same argument hold. I don't know. Maybe the series, you know, it's a longer
book. Yeah, maybe they liked the Colleen Hoover books better.
They liked the books better. You know, Hook, Line, and Sinker, what we just talked about, sold 20,000 copies in week one. Interesting what it sells next week. What's the durability? What's the shape and durability? Where the Crawdads Sing, by the way, trade paperback frontlist, 9,800 last week. We saw the first look. You texted to me and I didn't respond because I didn't want to get into
you
it.
You couldn't?
Look, I think we said this before. I assume that the movie will be better than the book. That is a low bar, but I think it could do some things better. It's going to be, it does look beautiful, I have to say. Are great. They look great on camera.
I mean, it looks beautiful, but like, it's kind of not, a lot of it's not supposed to. Like, she,
yeah,
you know, I mean, we don't need to rehash, but Manic Pixie Swamp Girl. Her life looks pretty cozy.
She's drawn dragonflies and reading books in the sunroom. It looks fine. I mean, anyway, we'll see. Do you think that movie's going to do? I mean, who knows with movies? It will even go in the theaters. Like, I don't even know what to make of expectations. I've long stopped that game. Books are hard enough.
I don't know. I don't know. I haven't heard a lot of clamoring for it. I think obviously a ton of people read that book. A lot of people who are casual readers picked that up as one of their couple of books of the year, or because their book club was reading it. It didn't spark anything near the like cultural excitement of like 50 Shades of Grey to translate into an adaptation. And I just don't know that there's really that much excitement for it. Maybe it'll capture people who didn't read the book but are like, people liked this book, maybe we'll see the movie.
I don't know. I don't really know. It's the kind of movie that's not getting made right now. Kind of a middle brow. I mean, in a different world, this could be a Hallmark kind of a movie or something a little bit.
I'm
not sure what to make of it.
It'll be really interesting to see what the trailer, kind of what genre the trailer packages it as, because the elements of the story that I think were most compelling to the people who liked the book were sort of the like solving the mystery revenge thriller elements. And if they are spinning the movie, the stills certainly look like they're spinning it more into this, you know, like very gauzy romantic kind of situation. That's a harder sell in general. You know, I'm like fresh off reading the book about rom-coms and how it took Hollywood approximately 1 million years to admit that rom-coms are a hard sell because they don't attempt to market them to men, but maybe if they did, men would go see them. And it doesn't look like, from the images of where the crawdads sing, they're trying to reach a broad audience.
Yeah. After coming off the Adaptation Nation we did of Gone Girl, like this feel good Gone Girl that where the crawdads scene seems to be going for is a very tough sell.
Feel good girl.
Yeah, that's not okay to say out loud. Nope. Early book of the year. So we've talked about this before. I'm just going to throw a couple of names out. We don't have a candidate right now. I wouldn't pick any horses that have left the places horse leaves when they start races. The Starting Gate. At this point, I will say this though. Now, again, some of it is the vicissitudes of publication date. You know what book is sweeping the nation has over the last year that we haven't mentioned at all? And it's a little outside of what we normally talk about. Atomic Habits by James Clear. This is selling everywhere. My better half was in like a productivity leadership thing where they were sort of basically doing using Atomic Habits as a conversation starter. It's all over the stores, selling very well. These self-development ones come, but we haven't talked about it. It sold 30,000 copies. It was the best-selling book of the week last week, and it has been for 6 months.
It's confusing because it came out in 2018.
Yeah, I know. I don't know.
And I think I read it in 2018.
Green Eggs and Ham was the third best-selling book, and it came out in, 1612 or whatever it came out.
So yeah, the thing with the self-improvement books becoming popular a year or two after their release, I guess it makes sense that they're more likely to sell in paperback just in general.
Right.
But these sort of, there's so many of them that which ones are actually useful, I think takes a while to shake out. I also thought Atomic Habits was very useful. But yeah, you're right. We have not talked about that one. And I think it's in our personal shared interests of things that we read about, but not so
you
much
did read it. We haven't talked about this. So it's worth picking up. You know what I like, what I like.
That? Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I don't know that there's anything that new for you know, there's a lot of habit stacking kinds of things, but you did like The Power of Habit, the Duhigg. I think this is a good follow-on, and it's a little bit more I found it to be a little bit more practical in the actionable stuff. Like, here's actually, you want to develop this habit, like, let's walk through how you could stack it up with these other habits, or you want to put these things together to like create your morning routine, say. Here's how you can chain things together, which Duhigg's I found to be a little bit more, you know, philosophical about like, here is how habits work. But you have to have a ton of mindfulness around it to like see the trigger that makes you want to do the thing that you're trying to stop doing, or to instill a trigger to make you do the thing you want to do. And the James Clear is like, why don't we just do these things, and it's like make them make sense to your brain in a way that you'll just start to do things habitually. Yeah. I think it's useful. Yeah. You could listen to it on audio.
I'll get to it eventually. I've seen it enough that it's, I mean, that I'm interested in that kind of book at all. But now it's sold enough that I just kind of want to know what the shtick is. Like when I finally got around to the life-changing magic of tidying up, I was like, okay, that's, you know, not for me and not solving a problem I have. I get it. And now I have it in the back of my brain. Couple of books that we've mentioned before. I don't think I picked this in the draft. I don't think that I did. But I think if I had to pick a title that's not, you know, it wasn't hugely anticipated, but it still continues to sell well, but it's also not one of these Patterson album, Lisa Gardner, you know, that kind of they fade, you know, they open and they're just kind of brand names. The Made by Nina Prose, still in the top 10. Mm-hmm. It's been out for a couple of months. It doesn't seem to be losing much steam, you know, still selling 6,000-ish copies in print a week. I think that's one that's a debut, I believe. Was that a debut? I can't remember. But that's a reader's kind of a book. It's an interest. I read it. I liked it well enough.
Oh, okay.
It's the, did we talk about this all? The protagonist is neurodivergent. And there's been there's a little talk about representation there. I'm not very well qualified to comment on it. Though I think I'm on the side of, if you're going to do it, this is pretty well done. I found it enjoyable. You know, my old binary, did you get into it or in? I was into it. So
okay, I was going to ask where you were on the scale of whelmedness.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mystery told a little bit differently. It's like upmarket mystery, literary mystery, I guess is what I would say. Mm-hmm. I thought it was good. You know, the one that continues, the Lincoln Highway, still in the top 10.
Someday I'm going to give in and read
it's
some
good.
Amor Towles.
I liked it, you know. People like things that are good. You're into Pachinko now, and it turns out you like things that are good as well.
It turns out I like things that are good that other people have liked. I'm about 300 pages in, so about 60%.
I told you an anecdote. I'd be curious for the listeners out there, they're out living their lives. If you happen to wander into a bookstore, I was in my local Pals recently, and I was going to pick up a copy of Pachinko for Michelle because it's the kind of book I think she would like if she'd get into it. And now that the show is coming out March 25th, she's like, was it good? What I think? Blah, blah, blah. I was like, okay, I'm just going to get you a copy. I'll put it on your nightstand and you'll pick it up eventually. I can be a part of the process here. But my local Pals was all sold out of new copies. It only had one old used ratty copy that would have not gone over well. You know, that's not the kind of thing. Whatever, it's fine. You know, pick it up for a few
bucks.
She's
a lady of fine taste.
She's a designer and these things matter. But I was shocked. I mean, it feels to me like there should be out there. Maybe there was a stack in the front, though I said before that when I went to go buy Hell of a Book after it won the National Book Award, they're like, oh yeah, that's back on the shelf somewhere with no special notes. So the responsiveness there. If you're in a Barnes & Noble local bookstore recently and you happen to wander by the big fiction stacks or whatever, in let me know if they have copies. I don't know if it's a staff. Are they sold out? Did they not print enough? Like, what is going on here? Because
maybe they're not paying attention to what Apple is putting out on adaptations.
I guess not.
Next.
I guess not. Maybe not. But I was surprised to not see it there. But speaking of preview drafts and things we liked, one I did want to mention is V.E. Schwab's new book, Gallant, came out. And I read that last week. And it debuted at number 2 in Children's Front List Fiction with 14,000 copies.
Okay.
So I don't know. It's okay.
It's fine.
Not that great. And we're also in the time of year when we're starting to get the Dr. Seuss rise. The number 3, 4, and 7 top 10 overall selling books of last year were
After
Dr.
what,
Seuss
like
titles.
May 15th?
Yeah, after school's
Dr.
out.
Seuss.
We're going to get Oh, the Places We'll Go will be the last gasp of the Seussian dominance for the year. That'll happen in mid-June, and then we'll start settling back down. But there's no candidates for Book of the Year. I think To Paradise, was a candidate. I don't. It's too long, and there was too much weirdness. It's too. I think it was too weird. It could win the Pulitzer Prize or National Book Award, and it might deserve it. But in terms of being a reading phenomenon, it was too tough.
Yeah, I think you could be long or weird and get moderately popular with like readers.
Right.
But
right.
Long and weird is a tough sell.
Yeah, to stay on the top 20 for 2 months, you've got to be the reading experience has to be pleasurable. And this was interesting. I think it's something other than purely pleasurable, which The Maid, I think, is, and The Lincoln Highway, I think, is, and The Christie Affair, I think, is, which is selling pretty well, and some of this other stuff. So anyway, there you go. Let's do another break, and then we'll do stories a little bit.
Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her soul family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. Let me ask you a question. How well do you think you know people? And how well do you think they know you? Six award-winning, best-selling authors of suspense explore the lingering threat of secrets and the inescapable fear that they can't stay buried forever. So no matter how dark the hiding place, the consequences of revealing the truth can bring out the worst in lovers, friends, family, and strangers. And check this out. You can read and listen to all six short stories in the Never Tell collection free with Prime. You can learn more at amazon.com/nevertell. And these best-selling authors include Liv Constantine, Laureth Ann White, Andrea Bartz, Rachel Housel Hall, Avi Pachoda, and Carolyn Kepnes. Again, you can read and listen to all six short stories free with Prime and also Kindle Unlimited. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
Sanderson. One question we had about Sanderson right away was, how surprised were they? Was this a, we really got something here and we're going to lowball the $1 million goal, but we know there's an FAQ, we'll put it in the show notes. I didn't get to read the whole thing. I didn't have time. There's some link that came to our attention this morning. I think the biggest takeaway from me was that he thought maybe 2 to 4 million was a generous upside. Mm-hmm. We're now approaching 8 times that, so it's well outside the scale there. So they didn't know. Phenomenon beyond that. Yes. Assuming this is true, I guess I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt that they're not sandbagging again. Sandbagging about sandbagging. What else, Rebecca, did you pull out of this
one? Yeah, you know, I have some deep appreciation developing for how grounded Brandon Sanderson seems to be and how direct he's willing to be with people. Like, one of the, of course, frequently asked questions here is, how are you going to spend the money? And he gives this answer that's like the same way I spend all my other money. Like he said, you know, it's a valid question, but I haven't been looking at this as really any different than the money that I earn from my books that are traditionally published. But I particularly liked this sentence. I didn't hit the lottery any more than any other business hits the lottery when they have a product that connects with their market. Right. So I'm like, yes, that is a good way to think about it. There's also a nugget in here that they're planning on building a physical bookstore. And so the money that he's earned here will help his company accelerate the plans to build their physical bookstore. He drops a lot of numbers. So I think, Jeff, when you're especially like interested or have some time to go dig in, because he did some predicting. He talks about like his most popular first week sales were for he talks about several of them. So he says, like, to pull the curtain back for you, Rhythm of War's first week sales were around 350,000 copies in all formats. Star Sights were about 80,000 copies in all formats. The first year for Rhythm of War was about 800,000 copies total. And when they started this project, they thought, like, okay, maybe we could get, you know, of those potential 250 to 800,000 people on a typical Sanderson book in the first year, how many of them could we get for our Kickstarter? And their guess was very low. So I think he underestimated the like real thirst from his fandom for these things, and maybe underestimated how many of those 800,000 in the first year people are, he already has connections to directly market to them, mm-hmm. to get the word out about something like a Kickstarter, or maybe the power of those networks that fans of especially like big sci-fi properties yeah. are in, where if one person is on the Brandon Sanderson list and he drops a Kickstarter like this, everybody that person knows is then going to find out about it 5 minutes later. So really interesting to see him talk about, you know, what he anticipated, and there's, you know, reasonable math around what he anticipated and why. Mm-hmm. Also, he addresses, is this the end of traditional publishing for you, and why did you kickstart these books? And that's really juicy, and there's so much of it that we couldn't possibly, like, you and I could dedicate like a 7-hour
well
podcast.
That's when I was like, whoa, I gotta stop, because it's either yeah. gonna be a light touch, or this is gonna be the thing we do for 6 years.
Yes, yeah, we could close read his answer to this question about the end of traditional publishing or not for a good long time, and I think we'd have a nice time doing it. But he talks about, you know, things in the past that he experienced with Amazon book sales, with ebooks. Audiobook is notably his most popular.
That was the
format,
one that I thought that was going to pick out for sure.
Man, you're committing to so many hours listening to a Brandon Sanderson giant sci-fi audiobook. That just surprised me. But he does pull back the curtain a little bit on some of the stuff that went on with Amazon, some of the stuff that went on with Macmillan, and then between Amazon and Macmillan that maybe had left not the best taste in his mouth or given him a desire to experiment with something else. And, you know, he does a nice job in a humble enough way of like patting himself on the back for knowing that he had enough direct connection to his market to try something like this, but also makes it pretty clear that at least right now he's not planning to leave traditional publishing forever. He talks about some of the benefits mm-hmm. of staying with traditional publishing, or the balance of what he gets from that versus what he'll get from doing this. So Bridget, really thoughtful. I wasn't expecting him to do several thousand words on what this experience was for him. And it's interesting. It's the most I've seen an author talk about something like this, especially on this scale of success.
I think goes back into this, is this replicable question? I mean, any author could write this kind of a yeah. thing about their project, but Sanderson does this. Like, this is why yeah. people are coming, like, there's a virtuous cycle of being either being seemingly well-adjusted or being able to perform well-adjustedness. Like, it's the Turing test of groundedness is interesting to think about as well. But yeah, there's a lot there. I think a lot of people don't operate pretty close to the metal of a company that they work for, and there's just such a thing as cost of goods sold and overhead mm-hmm. and operating. Like, they see $20 million and it looks like winning the lottery. Well, winning the lottery, you don't have to go pump out subscription boxes for a year and make these special editions, and he has right. a staff. I think the other thing I took in my brief glance is, like, Sanderson got a lot of irons in the fire, and a yes. lot of them make money. Uh-huh. And that is maybe something that someone who sees $25 million would be like, that must be like literally everything you're ever going to make. Sanderson's a mini industry of his mm-hmm. own. And that's a differentiation when we talk about what the other authors that could do like this. I think the Sarah J. Maas was still a great answer. I'm not sure she has the infrastructure that Dragonsteel Entertainment or whatever, the N.K. Yeah, Jemisins. We got another email this week about Martha Wells and the Murderbot mm-hmm. series. I think it's a really good example.
A good one. Mm-hmm.
But I think the special sauce here is this is a business already with staff, like 20 yes. staff, something like that said.
Yeah, they already have a warehouse they're going to yes. ship all of these books out of, which answers one of my original mm-hmm. questions about how that was happening. Yeah.
So it's less, it makes more sense, I guess, after reading this was my
yeah, I think so too. And it helps, I mean, it has to help that he does seem like a nice, like a genuinely decent, grounded yeah. human that you can feel good about giving your dollars directly to. Mm-hmm. He also notes in here that one of the complications of this was that it cuts bookstores out, you know, doing sales directly this mm-hmm. way, and he wants bookstores to continue to thrive, and he knows that his sales can contribute to that. So what might some sort of hybrid model in the future look like? I think this is a really good example of somebody trying to see the whole board and understand their place in the ecosystem and breaking down the costs and opportunity costs of doing the benefits and opportunity costs of having done it this way.
Really soft-pedaled the shorthand was New York, but traditional publishing is what yeah. that meant. Is like, would we have made more or less? it's going to take years to figure it out. And he's right. You know, mm-hmm. you're going to, you have the amateur stuff and copyright and service and all that stuff takes a long time to really parse out. So it was a, it wasn't a wet blanket over the whole idea, but a moment of useful, transparent, real mm-hmm. talk that really gets into the double-edgedness of self-publishing, right? Because now you got to do it all. You get all the money, but then you got to do it all, which I think, in the earlier days of the new utopia of self-publishing, the work doesn't go away because you'll self-publish. You just get to do it. Mm-hmm. And you assume you're going to be A, as good, and B, more efficient, and C, enjoy it. When you put it that way, it's like, I get why people don't do it.
Yeah,
I do.
Yeah, I wonder how many people saw this or will see this who were thinking, maybe I'll try that.
Yeah, and I hope they read this and not just look at the Kickstarter number, right?
Right. God. Yeah, and it does seem like, I checked the Kickstarter again this morning, it was at 27-ish million last week when we recorded, and it's at about 29 and a half right now. So it's slowing down, but like it's still got $2.5 million bigger in the last week.
Well, and we know too, and again, I assume it's similar, the first week and the last 48 mm-hmm. hours are the most indicative, so we might see here at the end. While we're not going to spend too much time on this. I think it's worth pointing out, it's a little outside of our canon. There's an amount of tea spilling that if we comment on too much feels a little bit, I don't know, gossipy, piling on. I don't know, but we haven't talked about this, Rebecca. We're going to handle this. Mm-hmm. But there's an interesting piece in Publishers Marketplace that we'll link to here about mid to low level publishing staff people. This is their great resignation moment and saying, this is enough, it's too much. And I think it does speak a little bit to how hard it is to publish stuff, right? Like it does dovetail a little bit with the Sanderson talk of like, there's not really a shortcut to making books and editing them and printing them and distributing them and, you know, marketing them and doing all the things that go into what we understand publishing to be. And there seems to be a generational divide in publishing about, and maybe it's always thus, and now people are like, maybe it shouldn't always be thus. I don't know. Is this something different, or people reacting to it differently? My thought is that it's door two here, with this is how publishing has worked for a long time, of low to mid-level publishing people bearing a lot of the brunt like they do in, say, medicine or law, frankly. And then once you climb the ladder, you reap the rewards of, you know, sort of a labor marketing scheme to some degree. And people are like, you know what if I didn't? I don't know. That's my take on this, Rebecca.
I think it's a little of column A and a little of column B, in that bearing the brunt looks different now than it looked a generation ago because technology has advanced so much. And one of the key things that the letter writer here, I can't find her first name, someone McGee, Molly McGee, who had resigned from Tor. One of the things that she particularly calls out is, at least in her experience, the burden of being responsible for like managing all of the technology pieces that the older and more senior
programming the VCR,
either couldn't or didn't want to manage. And those are new technologies that weren't a regular part of publishing, you know, 30 years ago. So I think some of it is that, a lot of it is just that how we understand corporate life and expectations of work-life balance, expectations of how people should be treated in the workplace and have their work valued, and this great resignation moment of people stepping back and looking at what they thought was important in their careers and in their lives. And maybe it's something very different than that, are combining to it. This was going to come to publishing because it's happening everywhere. So
yeah, it's worth looking at if you're interested in the labor stuff.
I think if you're listening to this show from your dorm room, or you're thinking about a career in publishing and wondering like what your Devil Wears Prada march up the ladder might look like, I would give this to, I don't know, a 22-year-old who is thinking about trying to move to New York and get a job as an assistant editor or a publicity assistant or something like that.
Yeah. It's a good piece. And it's something that's, when you and I read this, and maybe listeners of the show, we've talked about over time a little bit, I was 0% surprised by anything in this, to be honest with you. No. Let's do Frontlist Corner. Today's topic for Frontlist Corner is... books that either lie to, well, lie to you is strong.
This is an airing of grievances. It's,
well, I may, sure, you can air your, I'm not sure that I'm aggrieved. I guess there's how to win and lose the expectations game when you pick up a book, right? And different things getting packaged different ways. And we have multiple data points this week shared that not the same books, but the same experience of like, this is not really what I signed up for. And I'm not sure that I'm okay with that. Is that yeah. fair? Is that
yes?
What
we have been on a journey this week.
Yeah. Now, yes. If we had read the blurbs fully, I don't know.
I don't know either.
So, do you want to start? Or do you want me to? Do you want to start?
I think you should start.
I should start. Okay. So I didn't tell you the other half of my experience,
oh, no,
which is it's fine. But I picked up and read this week The Swimmers by Julia Tsuka, which came out. Julia Tsuka has written a couple of really beautiful novels, Buddha in the Attic and When the Emperor Was Divine. I followed her career. She has a new one out. And I kind of know what to expect. The contemplative can be very impactful and mournful. And this one even more so because the premise, it's a strange book. I would like to talk about it at length with people who would like to do those sorts of things. Did you read this?
It's like next on my stack. So I am very interested in what you're about to say.
Maybe it'll make the pod. Maybe it won't. But like the first half is, first person plural. So we and us, right?
Mm-hmm.
About people who are like hardcore amateur swimmers at this local private swim club, and something happens there, and that's the first half of the book. And then I think one of the people there in the second half of the book is the second half is also second person, we, us, but it's way more specific about someone's mother going into a memory care long-term facility, right? So it's pluralizing that. It's pluralizing two very specific experiences is what's happening. And then the link is the woman who's going into the memory care, I think it was one of the swimmers. We get a little bit of her. They're interesting. They're metaphors that abound. I haven't read any of her interviews. I'd love to. It's one of the few times I really want to hear more about why these two things got jammed together and how they came to be. But long-term memory care, I mean, is there a tougher hang in the world, right? And I have some personal experience of dealing with this, and I knew it would be close to the bone. So
I'm seeing a lot of fiction around dementia coming out lately, and that's just an interesting trend.
Well, it's going to be like divorce or sexual assault. It's one of those banal quotidian traumas, right? That a lot of people are going to have this kind of very intense experience. And it deserves, like those experiences, a full literature, a full corpus to explore. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I knew that was going to be tough. I knew it wasn't very long, but I wasn't going to sit it. I thought I wasn't going to do it all in one sitting. I did it in one sitting. Anyway,
oh
my
boy.
Fault. Whatever.
That's a lot.
But I was like, okay, at the same time, I'm going to be listening to something, lighter, interesting. You know how I am. History of the World in Seven Things. I like a year in the life, like a year in the life of the garbage collector or a fisherman, whatever. So I picked up this book, came out in February, Funny Farm, My Unexpected Life with 600 Rescue Animals. And the cover
sounds perfect.
The cover has all these, you can look it up. It's by Lori Zaletsky. Has all these animals sort of poking around. It looks light and fun, right? And her backstory is as tough as it gets. And almost every trigger warning I can think of applies to some degree. And I was not expecting
and
it.
It is nowhere in the synopsis because you shared this.
Thank
with
you.
Me.
I shared. I was like, okay, there's heartbreak here, and like, I'm not sure that you run a 600 rescue animal shelter if you don't got a little something that you're dealing with. I don't think that's outside there. I was expecting like to deal with my divorce or maybe my mom died but Rebecca Shinsky, I got to tell you, it was a Whitmonian catalog of pain. It was interleaved and weirdly whiplash between a funny story about a pig that got out with my dad trying to kill me and my family with an axe. I mean, that's not hyperbole. Jeez. That's a scene that actually happened. Spoiler. So, okay, it was tough, but
that's
then you got into Left on 10th, which I think is a memoir of love and loss is the subtitle of that
it
book.
It is.
Is
it's
that
a,
wrong?
A second chance at life.
Yeah.
And
go for
well,
it. You do yours.
I'm looking at the synopsis of Left on 10th right now, and all the things that have been surprises to me are in the synopsis. So I really, could have saved myself, and I would have read it anyway. I would have just, you know, known what was coming for me. But, well, first, I want to go back to Funny Farm for a second, because I think that there are ethical decisions that publishers make that maybe they don't realize they're making when they decide what goes in a blurb for a book or not. Mm. And when you leaving out minor details is not an ethical problem. Not, right. You know, putting a spoiler into a blurb, not an ethical problem. Like, you are giving someone an emotional experience, and in a work of writing, you're manipulating somebody's emotions for like 300 pages. And to put a cover on for a book called Funny Farm that looks light and wonderful and it's the thing you landed on when you were like, what's the balance to having to read this fiction about, you know, end of life and memory care stuff, and then to not give readers any warning that they're going to run across all kinds of triggering material like you just ran across can be really damaging. Like, you know, it's a hard read for you. It could have been a really damaging experience for someone to come across that kind of content. And I don't know what we do in
This was a hard book to market. I'll say that. I don't know how you do this with this book.
I've been thinking about it a lot lately. Like, I have not landed yet, at least in the place of publishing should come up with some universal system for trigger warnings, like what we have with movies, and all those things should go on book spines. Like, I'm not there yet. I know some folks are, and that's, I understand it. But I do think that mentioning it in a blurb of like giving some hint is helpful. And I had a really positive experience when I was reading In the Shadow of the Mountains last month, which is about hiking Everest, but it's about hiking Everest because she's dealing with trauma from childhood sexual abuse and addiction. And both of those things are mentioned just, you know, like in one sentence in the blurb. So if you were a person who was looking out for particular kinds of content, you could know that you were going to run up on that in that book. They didn't make it the point of the whole blurb, but like, it's there if you could find it. Anyway, that's my side rant. Left on 10th does actually include all of the things in the blurb. But since I did not read the blurb, I got surprised by her husband dies. And then I got surprised by she has leukemia, which is personally a difficult thing for me to read about. And then I got surprised by suicidal ideation entering the chat. And it was like, this is a lot. And it's especially a lot for like a book with a dark pink cover and gentle, like, you know, lilting scripted text on the front.
Yeah. I don't know. I think we're both kind of talking around a similar point, which is like, there's not any material for me really that I need a trigger warning. Like, I don't get triggered. That's not something that is in my experience, and having an experience that I think rises to that level. Some of it is about like, are you getting what you think you're buying?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the other is within that, how do you then let people know? Like, for example, Funny Farm, this looks like a book. This is a book for animal lovers. I think this has like it has a social media presence. Like, it's a well-known thing in Jersey. And like, this would be a great book to do about this. Those kinds of people that are animal lovers that are going to buy a book because there's a chicken and a baby goat on it also are the same kinds of people that give us TBR notes about, I don't want the dog to die.
Right.
Right. I think that's fair. Let me tell you about Funny Farm. The dogs die. Mm-hmm. Horses get murdered by estranged husbands. Like, it is rough for the animals.
That's really rough.
It's really rough. And it's almost exactly the kind of things that someone wants that buys this book doesn't want. That's what really gets me. It's not just like, well, there's this dark stuff. And then the last line is, although there are some sad parts, as life always is, which is a number that's a grammatical mistake, there are lots of laughs. This is not Babe Pig in the City. Like, it's a very, very dark part. And maybe that's a different book, and maybe it means you need to leave it out. And I know Laura Zaleski wants to tell her mom's story, especially because it's super important. And I get that. And maybe it's hard, and that's tough. But I there's something weird. I have a little more sympathy for the Delia Ephron writing about her experience and you telling it what it is. Maybe in those situations, signing up for Delia Ephron, like, I don't know that I need to be prepared. I'm not sure, because what do I want to know? How much do I need to know? Because there's pleasure and surprise too. But if it's not what you bought on the tin, and the tin didn't say what it was, like, I don't know.
for, I get to be really fair to Delia Ephron, like, I am enjoying the experience of listening to Left on 10th. I'm going to recommend this book. If I had read the synopsis, I would have picked it up, and it is giving me what it is selling in the synopsis. Yeah. And I think she is coming around to, like currently suicidal ideation is in the chat, but she's coming around to how her friends and caregivers helped her get the treatment that she needed to deal with both the leukemia and the depression, and what it was like to be surrounded with love and community and overcome these things and have a new understanding of, you know, end of life kinds of questions. And these are all things that I'm interested in thinking about and exploring and reading about from wise people who have gone before me. So, like, I would have picked it up anyway, and it would have given me what it was selling. I was just, this one's my own fault. I was just, you know, repeatedly surprised.
I think that's a good point of distinction, because now, no, I wouldn't have done this book. I didn't want educated plus Charlotte's Web. I it's not what I was looking for.
Yeah, then. And I do like the experience of being surprised by books, which is why I tend to go in cold. Yeah. So it matters that what the book looks like is what it's going to feel like on the inside. And maybe that's on me also, but I know a little bit too much about publishing and how book covers get made to believe that that they're always trying to accurately represent the contents with the cover.
Yeah, because, I mean, the old cliche is you don't judge a book by a cover, but frankly, if you haven't read the book, what else are you supposed to judge it
by? They're hoping that you will, and they're trying to sell you what they think the most appealing cover is, because once you take it home, like, they've made their money.
So those are, and then that brings up another packaging question. Is this where you're going next? I'm sorry.
It is the Brené Brown question.
The Brené Brown. And this is more of a, we've wondered about this. It looks like it's meant to be a gift book, Atlas
of
the Heart, right?
It does,
And you took a look at it, and you've got, it's that and more, or that and different.
It is. I guess this is kind of an inversion of the other experience, where historically, as listeners of the pod know, I'm a, like, first day the book comes out, new Brené Brown reader. And so I had pre-ordered Atlas of the Heart, and then it showed up. And, like, I pre-ordered it just because I like Brené Brown. I didn't really need to know anything else about it. Right. And when it showed up, and it's not a regular hard size book. It's about the size of a coffee table book. It's beautifully designed. Like, it's called Atlas of the Heart. It has all of these glossy kinds of pictures in it. And I unwrapped it, and I was like, oh, I wanted, like, 300 pages of thinky think about emotion and vulnerability. And this looks like a gift book. It came out around the holidays. One of my sisters-in-law received 3 copies of it at Christmas.
Like, what?
It's the places you'll go for the early 40s white lady crowd.
She pulled me aside at Christmas, and she was like, do you have the new Brené Brown? I was like, yeah. And she's like, oh, damn it. I got 3 of them. And, like,
that's,
I was hoping,
unbelievable,
I could give you one. I know. But, like, it came, right? Like, it came out at the holidays. It looks like a gift book. It seemed like this is the thing that's on the front table at Barnes & Noble that you give your sister-in-law that you don't know.
It should be called For Your Sister-in-Law by Brené Brown.
Is there a little subtle shade in that? Like, you got 3 copies of the new Brené Brown book for Christmas. And so I just sort of was like, oh, this is not what I was wanting from Brené Brown. I had heard her on an interview talking about, like, that this was sort of the summary of all of the things that she had learned in her past research. And I was like, well, I've read all of your past research, so do I actually need
Are you doing
this?
More qualitative field work, Brené? Because it seems like you're talking into head mics for a corporate dollar.
Yeah, she's got to rumble with it for a minute, Jeff. So it's just been literally sitting on my coffee table for months. And over the weekend, I was in between books, and I was like, let's just see, you know, what Brené is up to. And it is big and beautifully packaged, but it's like a taxonomy of language for emotion in a way that I think is super helpful. Like, here are emotional places we go when things don't go as planned. And then she breaks down, like, what is the definition of frustration? What is the definition of disappointment? What is the and how are these things meaningfully different from each other? All towards the end of, when we have language that's more precise, we can express and understand ourselves and other people more effectively. And it's like, this is interesting and useful. Now I know the actual difference between envy and jealousy. I also know that there is an opposite of Schadenfreude called Freudenfreude, which is when you have joy for someone else's joy.
Freudenfreude. That makes sense.
Freudenfreude. It's fun to say.
And then is there Schaden, where you feel bad about other people feeling bad?
I don't know. She doesn't go into. Okay.
Well, you know, that's the, what is it?
But the, how by to, the transitive
how to
properties
cook everything. And then there's like how to, there's a sequel to How to Cook Everything that makes me mad. Not a real atlas, Brené. You left Freudenfreude.
So I'm having a lot of like, why did they package this book this way? You pointed out this book is selling. So they packaged it this way because this will sell better than a hardcover called Dare to Lead. But it makes me feel like maybe a lot of folks are also missing the wonderful contents, because if you're wanting Brené Brown and you pass this up, I don't know. But it also is not what I thought it was going to be. And we've just had a trio of those.
Yeah. I mean, it's clearly packaged to be a physical object. And the gift book is, I don't mean to shade that, because I think it was meant to be given a gift as packaged that way. But it's not a gift book like... quotations or something like that. There's more. You're saying there's more substance here than you thought.
Yes.
And does the packaging help or hurt that? And does it matter, really? I think that's a fascinating question. I think, you know, to bring it back around before we leave the show today, I think it's interesting to contrast it with Atomic Habits. Who's reading? I think gender breakdown and also class is interesting to think about with these. I'm guessing Atomic Habits is business book people.
Yeah.
And Atlas of the Heart is no shade on your family, but it's like, I don't know, people that it's the upmarket version of it's marketed as a upmarket version of the pillow of Live, Laugh, Love. That's what it looks like to me.
Yes. Yeah. It's like, it's more expensive than a traditional hardcover. It's priced closer to what a coffee table book would cost you. So it does feel like getting or giving a gift type book. Right. I also feel, maybe this is maybe my own like readerly neurosis, but I feel like unserious when I'm sitting there reading it. Like when when I sit down to read something about self-improvement or emotion or, you know, ethics or what, all that stuff we like to read about, I'm used to like, I have the book in my hand, there's a pen in my hand, I'm ready to like take a note and learn a thing. And nothing about this object says to me, okay, like gather around children, let's learn some things.
Right. This is like Magnolia Table, Joanna Gaines's home decor kind of
book. Like how many copies wrong of this with book that. And, are actually maybe, being read?
Yeah, that's great. And if the point is to get more eyeballs to these ideas, this could be the right strategy. The very kind of people that are like, there's the opposite of us, the Freudenfreude of us, who are turned on by this. This makes feel more approachable, more giftable. You know, your sister didn't get three copies of 4,000 Weeks.
Yeah.
Right? Which we both found life-changing is strong, but very, very impactful.
Very meaningful.
And very meaningful, and we passed it on. But it has a certain seriousness that's going to be a turnoff for some people. Because if you don't read a lot of self-development, you're not used to, is this for me? How do I understand this? Is this even going to be enjoyable? This book feels approachable. And for us, I think our bad, I'll say myself, my bad first reaction is it feels gauche. And it's at the end thing by Target, by the scented candles. So my dude-ness or whatever else is kicking in saying, not for you, man. But I also like Brené Brown and I was interested too, but I didn't even pick it up. And that's on me, right? I didn't give it a chance even.
I also think, next time you're in Powell's, look for this and flip through it, because I would be really curious about what you think looking at the insides. But I also really wonder if the folks who did pick it up, because it looks more approachable, are getting what they thought they were getting. Because it looked to me like I was expecting a lot more illustration, maybe like graphs of stuff. But it's a lot of text. It's just the text is like a big font. And they're like, Bob could read it across the room. It's a big font. And there are some, you know, full page photos from her life, and it has like more personal touches. So I kind of get what they were going for, but I wonder if anybody got what they thought they were getting.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, if Schadenfreude were neither of the words work.
Yeah, like
work
whatever
exactly
your
right.
reason for picking up this book or not picking it up, does it give you what you thought you were going to get when you either chose it or chose not to read it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Is it the places you'll go? Like I said, is it like something that people are giving and buying and passing around and sitting on coffee tables? Because it continues to sell. It was the fifth best hardcover frontlist nonfiction book of the week last week. So it's selling 10,000 copies, almost as much as the new Sarah J. Maas. So from a business point of view, again, we don't know what the revenue split and the advance and all that kind of stuff. But I'm looking now at some of the look inside stuff. I don't know what to make it. I don't know what to make of this. I mean, I almost want more of a, I don't know. Like, what's Maggie Nelson's version of Atlas of the Heart?
Yes.
Right? Like,
Ross
is Brene,
Gay.
Like, is Brene Brown, like, is she thrilled that this is the packaging for this? There's the question I want.
Yes.
Because maybe it is. Maybe she's like, this is the accessible handbook that people, it feels approachable, and it feels like it's something you could give as a gift and read for fun, but I'm not sure that sneaking is the right thing in there, but like, there's a lot of sugar for this medicine. There's a lot of interest and visual interest, and it doesn't feel intimidating, and it has this weird clip art version of a heart that's supposed to be an atlas, but it looks kind of like a bird with flowers on it. I don't know.
Like, I think if they wanted to go accessible, there's a way to do that that's like feelings and what they mean, you know, where somebody who's sitting down at midnight in a dark night of the soul to be like, how to talk about emotions could land on this book would be incredibly useful, I think, for a person having an experience like that. Or I was telling somebody, I think I was telling a friend who has teenage kids, like having all this different language for different like shades of emotion would have been super useful to me as an angsty 13-year-old. Maybe it will be useful with your angsty 13-year-olds. And there's a way to package a book that will sell. Like I might also nope out on a book marketed that way. That's my own other stuff, but it would probably sell more broadly, and it would achieve, I think, the goal of teaching this information to people.
Yeah, there's like an upmarket or I don't know, a seriousness, or let's call it the pretension scale, right?
Sure.
Where this is like kind of real close in the middle because it has a gold embossed element to it, but Atlas of the Heart is a pretentious title. No shade, but that's a pretentious title. It just is. Yes. It's not as pretentious as the life-changing magic of tidying up. Like that's a strong statement, Marie.
It's not practical at all. Yeah. Atomic Habits, very practical.
But it's also not everything I needed to learn I learned in kindergarten, right? That's right. The more very aw shucksy, you know, down home wisdom.
Seven this habits is, of highly effective
yeah,
whatever.
Who moved my cheese, which is tongue in cheek and that kind of stuff. This feels very in the middle, which maybe what we're reacting to is we don't get many of these. Like these very in the middle, high, low, qualitative research, TED talker, motivational speaker with the resume who we've read a bunch of and really like, but maybe we feel like we've gotten the message. Like she's an unusual person. It's an unusual book. Maybe it's not a surprise that we're feeling some, we're not sure what to
yeah,
do with
I think
it.
It's very unusual at our with our experience and how long we've been doing this to land on a book where it's like, what is this animal?
What is this? Yeah.
Yeah.
What is this? Yeah. Cool. Well, that we got way more into that than I was expecting, but it's out there in a fascinating physical object to see if you've loved Atlas at the Heart or felt some. How many copies have you received of Atlas at the Heart? Is some kind of what? How many copies of Atlas at the Heart you received says about you? The BuzzFeed quiz that we all need. You can shoot us an email podcast. At bookriot.com. You can find the links to this and all back episodes, show notes to this and all back episodes of the Book Riot podcast and all the other Book Riot podcasts at bookriot.com/listen. Rebecca, we'll talk to you next time.
Have a good one.